Hello, welcome everyone to another episode of Microsoft Developer Radio. This week, we are focusing on Windows Azure, and specifically, we're going to be talking about Windows Azure Mobile Services. This is the, I think, third or fourth in the series that we've been running, and along with me today is my co-host, Brian Hitney. Hey, Brian, how's it going?
It's going great, Peter. I hope everything up there is going well. Down here, the weather's been fantastic. Today we're going to be talking about Windows Azure Mobile Services and what Andrew's been doing with that. Now, one of the most exciting things Who is Andrew? Wait, we have
another person with us on the show.
Another person with us today.
Yeah. Andrew.
Windows Azure Mobile Services rocks.
Andrew, your voice has changed.
Yes, it has. No, So I'm one of Brian and Peter's colleagues. I'm a technical evangelist out of the DC area. And I've been working on a blog series based on building back-end services for a couple of Windows Store games. And we've been talking about different parts of the Windows Azure stack and how you could build a back-end service with them. So today we'll talk about Windows Azure Mobile Services and its role for building back-end services.
That sounds great. Now, specifically, one of the things that I have to admit, I love what we're doing with mobile services, and I actually have no problem saying that I typically hate JavaScript, but there's a little bit of a tease in there,
you're
right?
Because so of biased, man. You're so biased.
I am, but I have to say I love what you can do with mobile services and JavaScript in particular, we'll get into that, I'm sure, as the show progresses. But one of the most interesting things this week has been a couple of new announcements, or maybe not necessarily just this week, but over the past couple of weeks, we've had a bunch of new announcements specifically with mobile services. So I don't know, Andrew, if you wanted to touch upon those, or Peter, if you had any thoughts about some of the new stuff we've got.
Yeah, well, one of the things that came out in the last couple of weeks was support for Windows Azure Mobile Services for Android clients. So the existing offerings in preview had been for Windows 8, Windows Phone 8, and Brian's trying to crack me up here, for Windows Store, Windows 8, or I'm sorry, for Windows Store, Windows Phone 8, and for iOS. And we had announced that we would have support for the Android platform, and that support came into the preview as of, I think, last week. So now if you're building Android apps, you can take advantage of the Windows Azure Mobile Services with a robust client library specifically made for that platform. The other thing that came this week, which I was really excited about, was support for HTML as a client for Windows Azure Mobile Services. I mean, as you guys know, because Azure Mobile Services uses HTTP as its communication protocol, it's, you know, basically kind of REST-based services, you could just kind of roll your own and go directly against those HTTP APIs, it's way too early for this, Brian. But having the same client library support for HTML clients as for the rest of the clients that had already been supported really provides an additional kind of ease of use, so that folks who, you know, maybe don't know quite as much about doing HTTP and REST can just very easily leverage a JavaScript client library to hit up the mobile services from HTML.
I think that's really impressive in terms of the breadth of the client libraries that are available there. You know, one of the things I think we're going to see when you demo this is that the small amount of code, if any, that you have to write, because it basically is going to do a lot of the work for you on the server side, setting this stuff up. And yet it's so easy to be consumed from any of these mobile platforms. I think that's a really great thing. So it's not just a benefit for, let's say, a Windows 8 developer or Windows Phone developer, which is what I think you're going to be focused on today, but it can also benefit the iOS, Android, and just, you know, people doing plain old HTML5 web development.
Yeah, well, and for what it's worth, I mean, you know, a lot of people want to have apps that can kind of cross the different platforms. I mean, you know, I, for example, have my Community Megaphone app for the Windows Store. There's also a version of that app that's on Windows 8, but was actually written by a fellow from the community here in Mid-Atlantic. And then there's the Community Megaphone website. And, you know, thinking about sort of moving all of that forward, You know, what if I was in a world where rather than having my own custom backend for the Community Megaphone website, what if I was able to leverage Windows Azure Mobile Services for the website itself and then utilize that exact same service to provide an app across, you know, Windows Store, Windows Phone, and perhaps even expand it to Android and iOS. And being able to leverage, you know, similar syntax and robust client libraries makes that really easy to do.
That's awesome. That's great stuff. So why don't we just start diving into some of the code?
Okay. So let's do a demo.
Brian, it looks like you're praying there. You worried that Andrew's demo is not going to work today?
No, look, it's Andrew. I think, you know, he got burned once, and I think everything is going to work out really well today. Right, Andrew? Because I'm sure you spent a lot of time this morning before we started recording making sure it's all ready to go.
Actually, I did my homework last night. Thank you, Brian. So yes, we're all good to go.
You guys can see how much fun we have doing these things. So anyway, with that, Andrew, let's stop with the teasing and show us what you got.
All right. So just wanted to show you really quickly on my blog. This is part of the blog series that we've been talking about, where I kind of walk through the steps to set up a Windows Azure mobile service for a backend. So you can go check that out on my blog. We'll have the link in the show notes. Now I'm going to switch over here. I've logged into the Azure Mobile Service or the Windows Azure Management Portal. So you can see here the URL is manage.windowsazure.com. And I've gone to the Mobile Services section of the Management Portal here. And then you can see I've already got an existing mobile service. We're not going to use that one for this particular demo. I'm going to create one from scratch so you can see the whole process. So the way that I do that is down here at the bottom, and this is pretty consistent across the services. I'm going to click New, and because I'm in the mobile services right now, it's going to automatically select for me Compute and Mobile Service. Notice that as of the time that we're recording this, mobile services are in preview mode. You can get up to 10 mobile services for free in the preview mode. They do work on a SQL backend, so you can do that on a 90-day free trial at no charge. You can do that using, if you have MSDN subscriber benefits, which is what I'll be using for my service. You can use that for your SQL database. You know, there's a variety of ways of doing it. If you don't have any of those and you want to pay out of pocket, I think the minimum size for the SQL database is $5 a month, so it's pretty inexpensive. And you can use the same SQL database for up to 10 services. Now, if I go here to the Create link and click that, so I'm going to click. It's going to give me a dialog that allows me to provide, first of all, I need to give a unique name for my service. Each of these services is going to use the format of myname.azure-mobile.net for the URL. That's because I'm using what's called a shared instance. If you want to, you can upgrade to a dedicated instance that gives you the ability to provide your own custom domain name. Since this is a service and pretty much nobody's ever going to be looking directly at the URL, it's easy enough to just provide whatever unique name I want. So I'm going to say game leader dash dev radio, and I'll get the little check mark here that says, hey, this is that name confirms as available. Now I can use an existing SQL database instance, but I'm going to show you creating a new SQL database instance. And I'm going to switch this over. This is going to use my MSDN subscriber benefits. And I'll create this in the East US. I could put it in East, West, North Europe, or East Asia. And then when I click the next arrow, it's going to ask me to specify the settings for my database. So I'll just leave the default name. I'll go ahead and select this server, which I had set up before. We'll use the login name DB user, and I'll come up with a super secret super secure password.
That's not 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, right?
Actually, that would not be allowed. So they're actually, if you create a brand new server,
that's my favorite password. How could it not be allowed?
Yeah, unfortunately, you have to have uppercase, lowercase, numeric, and special symbols in your password. So the funny thing is, I've actually created a password that has all of that, but which is probably not terribly secure. But I'm not going to tell you what it is. But the nice thing is at least we do kind of make the effort to make you think about security in your passwords. I could configure the advanced database settings, which basically kind of lets me choose the maximum size. I'm going to leave that as the default, which gives me kind of the default smallest database size of 1 gigabyte. So what's going on here is, under the covers, Windows Azure is creating a database for me on the server that I specified, and then it's basically building out a virtual machine on some hardware and installing all the bits for my mobile service. And you can see we've got the check mark that means my service is ready. I'm going to go ahead and click the URL and verify that this is actually up and running. And so what we'll get is just a placeholder page that says, hey, this is up and running. I can get some information. Let's go back to the portal. So now that I've actually got my mobile service, let me go ahead and click into that and take a look at the options here. So when we first click into a mobile service, the dashboard is going to take us to a quick start page. And this quick start page has some instructions on how to either create a new app of a given type or to connect to an existing app. If it's your first time with a mobile service, I recommend you walk through the tutorial here under Create a New Windows Store App. So what this tells me is, hey, a couple of things you need to do here. You need to go ahead and get the Visual Studio Express for Windows 8. That's a free version of Visual Studio for building Windows Store apps. I already have that installed, so I don't need that. Then there's a link to install the mobile services SDK. So basically, this is going to install the client libraries that you need to build these apps on the client end. Then there's also a step here where you can create a table. I'll show you how we do that in terms of the in terms of our existing app. But when you're walking through the tutorial for a new app, this just creates a to-do item table in your mobile service. And then you can download an app template either in JavaScript or in C#, and just run that, and it'll have everything wired up to your specific application. So it's a very easy way to kind of learn how to get started and how to work with Azure Mobile Services. And again, you can do that on the Windows Store app platform. You can do that for a Windows Phone 8 app. You do it for iOS, for Android, and now even for HTML.
Hey, Andrew, just curious to see, like, for iOS and Android, do they have those same types of resources in terms of the instructions and the demo code that you can generate?
Yeah, absolutely, they do. And so if I went over here to Android and click Create a New Android App, notice that it tells me I need to install the Android SDK. Now, there's an important caveat here. The tutorial specifically requires Android 4.2. I got some reaction on this from folks who wondered whether that was the only platform that was supported. But if you go to connect an existing Android app, notice that here for the Android SDK, Android 2.2 plus is what we support. Right? So basically it gives you the instructions for adding in the things you need to your app, including the client instantiation code, and then shows you how to store data inside your mobile service. So there's great instructions, whatever the platform it is that you're choosing.
That's awesome that they really thought to build that out ahead of time to make this really cross-platform.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the key is this is a really simple way to build back-end services that will work across a variety of platforms. Now, you see there's a bunch of tabs here at the top. I'm going to take a look at the data tab. One of the things that says here is you have no tables. That's kind of ominous. But when you create the service, you know, for the first time, it's not actually going to have a table for you to refer to. So I'm going to go ahead and add a table. I'm going to call this game score. And notice that one of the things we've got here is a list of permissions. So basically, the way that the services are set up is when I create a new table, the mobile service will automatically create matching, essentially RESTful type services available at an HTTP endpoint using my URL. I might want, for example, if I had a service where I wanted anybody to be able to read the data, I could change the setting for the read permission to everyone. So anyone could go out and call the API to read the data from my service. But the rest of it, only anybody with the application key can do. Now, I might even want to make it more restrictive where the only people who can delete records are authenticated users. So I've got the ability to tweak the permissions and make sure that you know, that they're sensible. I'm going to leave the defaults of anybody with the application key, and I'll show you what that means here in just a minute. So we'll go ahead and click this. It's going to go through and create that table for me. So now we can see we've got the game score table. So it's got one index and no records. If I click through to the table, you can see we've got tabs for browsing the data. It has no data. And then if I click on this, it'll take me back to the tutorial. You can see there's a script tab. I'll come back to that momentarily. It's got a columns tab. In the columns tab, you can see we have one column, ID, which is a big int, and it's indexed. So by default, when you create a new table, there aren't any columns built into it, and I'll show you why that is here shortly. And then if we want to tweak the permissions after we've created the table, we just go to the permissions column, or permissions tab, rather. Make sense so far?
Yeah, that's great. In fact, the one thing that I find just so compelling about this is that if you go back to the page where we have all the demos on there, that uh-huh. front page, is yes. that all of those are tailored specifically for your app. So it literally is cut and paste code. Not, you know, you have to, you know, take this code and put in your own app key, right? Those right. any project templates that you download right, exactly. there are tailored for your mobile service.
Right. So if I go, so let's look at our scenario, right? I want to connect an existing Windows Store app. I've got a couple of games that I want to hook up. I follow the instructions, right? I've already got the mobile service SDK, so I don't need to take the time to do that. I can choose whether I want to use C# or JavaScript. In my case, I've got a game that's based in HTML and JavaScript, so I'm going to leave the default JavaScript choice here. Now, what it's telling me is in my Visual Studio project, I need to add a reference to the mobile services JavaScript client and add a reference to the mobile services JS in default.html. So I'm going to grab this code here, right, and I'm going to copy this, which includes my URL and includes my application key. So that's the key that in order to create an instance of the library and access those insert, update, delete, and read methods, I need that key to be able to do that because of the permissions that I set on my table. So let's flip over to Visual Studio, and now I've got my Space Cadet game. This is, again, based on some work that our colleague David Izbitsky did. So I'm going to delete the existing reference to the mobile services JS. Notice that I've already got a reference in my project over here in Solution Explorer to the Azure Mobile Services SDK. Now, if I right-click references and say add reference, this is what it looks like. So this is the Windows Azure Mobile Services JavaScript client. So if I check this checkbox, click OK, that's how I add the reference. And then when I want to add the script reference to my page, I can simply grab this and drag it over to my page and drop it in, and that's added. Now, I also have a reference in default.html to this file called leaderboard WAMS.js. Now, folks who have been following this series will know that part of what I did in the blog post series and we've talked about in the Dev Radio series is I wanted to provide sort of an abstract interface for my game leaderboard code such that I could easily swap in and out different backends. So you can see I have a JavaScript file for OData, I have a JavaScript file for Web API, but all of them use the same interface to the game itself that makes it really easy to to just swap those out just by changing script references. So right now we're working with leaderboard WAMS.js. So let's go ahead and take a look at that. So what we've got here is, again, we're using this module pattern or immediately executed pattern. Basically, if you kind of look at the way the JavaScript works, there's this anonymous function, and then the parents at the end tell it to execute immediately. So that gives us all of our variable definitions. It also sets up this namespace. This is a WinJS function that allows me to basically provide an externally facing API from this file. So I have a set player name in it, add win, add loss, add tie, update score, and then my leaderboard methods get top 10 scores, get top 10 wins, etc. So that's sort of the externally facing thing, and then I can change the internal code as much as I need to work with different services. So in this case, in my init method right here, or my init function, what I need to do is set up a leaderboard client instance based on the mobile service client information and using the application key. So I'm going to replace this code with my code that I just copied from my new service. And I'm going to change this because I customized that name, so leaderboard client. And that's really all I need to do to get this set up to work properly with my service. So I'm going to go ahead and save that. Now I want to look briefly over some of the rest of the code here, just for folks who haven't seen before. So in init, what I'm doing is basically saying I'm going to have the specific game pass in the name of the player and the name of the game, and I make sure that those are actually have values, and then I'm setting them to the appropriate items. And then when I instantiate my client, I'm going to go ahead and get a reference to the game score table. Right now, if I don't have a game score table defined in my service yet, I'll get an error message because basically the Windows Azure Mobile Services allows for dynamically creating columns, but you can't create tables specifically from the client-side code. So you do need to create the table ahead of time on the server side. So I've got my game scores table, and then I'm going to do a where query. So this is a little different than what I had done in some of the other libraries. In the other libraries, I used kind of the URL query language of OData, which is supported both in WCF data services and in Web API, which we showed before, to build up a URL that did this kind of similar where query. In this case, what we get is a more link-like syntax. So I say game scores table where, and I pass in the player name and the game name. And then I call this function called read. So I'm basically saying where the player matches the player name and where the game matches the game name, I want you to give me all of the rows that match. And then it actually uses promises, as in WinJS. And so I call this done function and pass in a function to be called when that operation completes. So basically, when that happens, if I get the game table back, or if I get a table result back, but there aren't any records in that table yet, I'm going to go ahead and create a new essentially instance of the game score object, and then I'm going to pass that object to a function called insert. And what that will do is create a first row in my table. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
Okay, cool.
Sorry, I was on mute there.
So
a pregnant pause for all of you guys.
And then because I'm instantiating this, or because I'm using the WinJS promise to wrap this whole function, I'm going to call the completed method or completed function, which tells the promise to go ahead and return back to the caller of init, and that basically would allow me in my game code to also have a done function. So I can basically do asynchronous programming and say once the game leaderboard stuff is initialized, then I can take the next few steps. Now let's take a look at what that actually looks like. All right, so I'm going to do a search for init and see if, there we go. So we've got leaderboard init. Now let me bump this font up a little bit just so we can see this a little bit better. See if I can, oh, nope, that's down. Wrong way. There we go. A little better, guys? All right. So basically what I'm doing is I have my namespace, right, leaderboard, and then I'm calling the init method, and I'm passing in the player name, and I'm passing in just a static string for the name of the game, Space Cadet. Now notice, I've got this done function, and then I'm passing in an anonymous function. And in this case, I'm not doing anything, but basically I'm using this for two reasons. One is if I had any specific initialization in the game that couldn't happen until the leaderboard had been initialized, I can put that code there, and that's the beauty of working with promises. Then I also have a separate function that I've defined in case there's an error in initializing the game. If an exception happens, that's thrown from that promise, then I can handle that exception here in my game logic. So again, I'm kind of isolating the leaderboard stuff and providing a nice hook for specific handling of either success or failure in the initialization code. And I'm not going to get too deep in the weeds in the code here, other than to say, we've got the typical things that you might have in a leaderboard. Like, I'm going to get the current player score so that I've got what's current in the table before I update it. I can change the player name, so I can use this set player name function to do that. I can increment the wins, losses, or update the high score. So all of these are things that I can do to take advantage of my leaderboard client code here. All right, so we've got our API defined behind our namespace. We've got all of our code in here. Let's actually run this and see what this looks like. So I'm going to run this on the local machine. And I've got a nice little play button. So I'm actually on a touch machine. This is my new hotness in terms of hardware. I've got the Lenovo Carbon X1 Touch. So this is actually really good for Space Cadet because it's kind of designed. I can use a mouse with it, but touch is pretty awesome. So I'll go ahead and hit play and start blowing up spaceships. So I've got it on a fairly short timer here.
You know, the funny part is, and I know, Andrew, we were looking just at your screen, but because you're using the camera on your machine as you're touching it, it's like there's an earthquake there or something. You know, your screen is shaking.
Right, because I have my camera attached to the back of the monitor. All right, so we can see that once the game is over, if my score is higher than my previous high score, I get this message, leaderboard updated. So it's gone through and retrieved the existing score, compared it to my current score, and if the one is larger than the other, it calls the service to update the high score. So I'll go ahead and click close. Now if I swipe up from the bottom and tap leaderboard, this will take me to the leaderboard page, which again is referencing the same leaderboard WAMS.js file. And you can see I've got my high score of 1400. Now, if I go back over here, I can say, let's say I don't want to be DevHammer, or let's say I want to be this is my Xbox Live gamer tag. I can go ahead and save that. What that's going to do is it's going to change on the backend service the name of the player, or it'll change on both my local machine and on the backend service, the name of the player. So we go back over now to my portal, and if I go to the data tab, one of the things we'll see here is we're now showing one record for my game score table. And if I browse this, we'll see now we have Space Cadet, we have Seeker, right? We just changed the name, and the score of 1400. So now if I go back over to Space Cadet and play another game and hopefully do a little bit better this time. We'll see. See if I can give the guys another earthquake here. There we go. So I got 1500 instead of 1400. The leaderboard's updated. Let's go back over to the portal and we'll refresh.
You know, the last two major earthquakes on the East Coast happened to be in Virginia, not too far from where Andrew is located. So that's not something to be mocking for Brian to be nervous for you there.
Yeah, no, well, not very close to me. The last one that I experienced was actually in central Virginia, and actually I was presenting the day that it happened, or Rachel, one of our other technical evangelist colleagues, was actually presenting, and I was out with the audience, and it was an interesting moment. We were in downtown D.C., and not something you expect to happen very often. So we've updated our record. Right now we've got my score is up to 1,500. I'm still the player Seeker. So all of our code is working nicely. And again, think about how simple that was, right? I didn't have to do a ton of custom code writing. I simply leveraged functionality that exists in that library that allows me to work with table objects and simple methods like insert and update and read. So it's very intuitive in terms of the programming model. I really like working with HTTP and XML HTTP request. You know, the XHR object in WinJS does a great job of, you know, wrapping that kind of AJAX style call in promises and making it easy to work with. But the reality is that a lot of developers, particularly those who are coming from a world where they use Link, the language integrated query, you know, where somebody's used to link, making that leap to kind of building a URL and doing HTTP requests can be kind of a steep learning curve. So I think that working with the mobile services client libraries really is kind of a smoother transition for folks who are used to that world of kind of link queries and things like that. All right, so kind of we've shown the functionality of the mobile service. We've shown that we can update the service, including the scores and the player name. Now, some other things I wanted to show you briefly, and then we'll kind of wrap up for this week, is in the mobile services portal, some of the other things that you've got here, if I go back into my data table, one of the things I can do, and I'll talk about this in the next show a little more depth, is there's a script tab that allows me to hook into the insert, update, delete, and read operations. This is actually based on Node.js. So Node runs on the server, and then we've got hooks for each of these events. It's insert, update, delete, and read, where, for example, if a record gets deleted, I can get access to the ID of the record that's being deleted. I can get access to the current user, assuming that user is authenticated. I get access to the request object here. And by default, we just do request.execute. But I can do things like I can log errors, or I can do logging in each of these operations. If I wanted to, for example, if there's an insert, I could check the new record and check it against another record in the table for this particular user, and then update that user by doing a push notification and saying, you know, your high score has just been obliterated, right? So I could introduce an element of competitiveness across users of my game, so that each time somebody gets knocked off the high score table, they have the opportunity to kind of jump back into the game and compete again. That's a nice hook that you can use to kind of bring somebody back to your app again and again.
So Andrew, there's a whole bunch of functionality then built in JavaScript-wise. Like you mentioned notifications. Just to tease a little bit, I think you can also send email. SendGrid has a built-in component. So there's a whole lot of built-in stuff you could just leverage in there via JavaScript, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are a number of different modules that you can use that are kind of built in on the server in mobile services. And we'll get into in the next episode, we're going to talk about push notifications. So we'll actually demonstrate that aspect of it, but there's a lot more to it than just push notifications. There's actually a whole Azure store now where you can purchase services that you can integrate into your Azure services. So there's actually quite a lot of things that you can do. Last thing I want to show is just a few of the other things that we've got in here. There's a scheduler service, so you can actually create scheduled jobs in a mobile service. So let's say, you know, every week I wanted just to, you know, send out some notifications based on new items in the database or new items in the service or a given table. I can do that here. I mentioned push notifications, so I can actually do push notification to Windows devices, Windows Phone or Windows Store, to Apple or Google devices. I can do authentication. We'll talk about that in an upcoming episode in probably a couple weeks. And I can do that against Microsoft accounts, Facebook, Twitter, and Google accounts. So all of those are possibilities for authentication, and it's really simple to do. Configuration, I wanted to point this out. So it gives me access to the information about my SQL database and SQL Server, but I wanted to highlight this enable dynamic schema setting. So by default, as I mentioned earlier, the mobile service defaults to a dynamic schema model, and that basically means that once I've created a table, I can add columns to my heart's content. If I do a query from the client side, an insert query, and the column that's mentioned in my insert query doesn't exist in the table, mobile services will happily create that for me. Now, the only downside to this is if you're someone like me who's prone to typos, if you have a column name that's a typo, the mobile service will gladly create that column name for you. So my suggestion is, if you're concerned about that, one of the things that you can do is kind of establish your baseline column schema by, you know, running some queries, and then turn this off. And then once you've turned that off, it will prevent typos from introducing new columns. You would get an error message instead. So just something to bear in mind there. And then last but not least for this episode, I want to talk just briefly about the scale. Right now we're in the free mobile service mode. which is using a shared server, et cetera. If I switch over to reserved, notice that I have a spending limit on my account right now, so it's warning me that, hey, you, if you do this, you're going to need to remove your spending limit. But I can then bump this up to multiple instances, right? And the reason I might do that is if I create a back-end service and, you know, for some reason my game becomes the next Angry Birds, right? I might need to have more than just one instance to handle the traffic. Now, if my game becomes the next Angry Birds, I'm probably not worried about the spending limit at that point because I'll be making some good money. But it's very easy to rapidly increase the scalability of your mobile service with just a couple of clicks and a save, right? And you can do the same thing in terms of your database. You can upgrade the size of your database. You can upgrade from a web to a business database very quickly and easily. I'm going to go back to the free mode since this is just a demo. So that's kind of the overview for Windows Azure Mobile Services to build back-end services for my Space Cadet game. My thanks to David Izbitsky for his game starter kit that gave me the code to get that game started.
Hey, Andrew, that's really great. Neat stuff. I'm really looking forward to seeing what you can do with some of the JavaScript to integrate notifications and whatnot. Are you going to be doing anything with authentication inside the app?
So yeah, I'll be doing that in a future episode. That's actually my next blog post that I've got planned, so I should be getting that out probably, hopefully it'll be out by the time this airs, and then after that we'll get on the schedule to do the recording around that. But yeah, so you notice like in the Space Cadet game I had the changing the player name. You know, one of the things that I can do with authentication is actually kind of build that into an authentication piece where if the user wants to participate in the leaderboard, they can sign in with their Microsoft or Twitter or Google account or whatever the case may be. And then we can kind of pull a username based on that or tie that username to the service that they're logging in with. Now, in most of those cases, when you log in with those identity providers, what you're really getting back for your app is some kind of a unique token, right? And so your app's still going to be responsible for doing things like associating that token with a username that's specific to your app. Because the bottom line is we want to be able to authenticate people, but we also don't necessarily want to have services that, you know, provide more information than the user's comfortable with, if that makes sense. But the nice thing about leveraging these different identity providers is that it makes it easy to add authentication to our apps without having to kind of create our own back-end, you know, username and password database and all of that kind of stuff, because that just gets hairy.
It's nice for the users.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
It's nice for the users, too, because then they can just play your game and log in with whatever credentials they want to use. They don't have to create a special account for just your game.
Exactly.
Which is really nice. So it's both user-friendly and developer-friendly.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's low friction on both ends. And if there's one thing I've found, you know, over years of developing web-facing stuff, you know, the higher the friction, the less the participation rate. And so if you want somebody to use an app regularly, you know, don't make them jump through a bunch of hoops. Nobody likes that. So, you know, most people have a Facebook or a Twitter account. You know, if they don't, they probably do have a Google or a Microsoft account. So between those four providers, you've got an awful lot of the population kind of covered already. And they don't, you know, like you said, they don't have to create a custom account just for your app.
Good stuff. Well, thanks for that demo today. I think that was a really great thing. And hopefully we'll catch up with you pretty soon to hear about the authentication piece in the future. And thanks, everyone, today for joining us with me, Brian, and Andrew here. And we'll see you next time on another Microsoft Developer Radio.